So good evening again. Again, thank you very much for coming this evening. You are very welcome here. Let me just give you a feel for what's going to happen this evening and what order things will happen in. So in just a second, I'm going to invite Jeremy Marshall to come and join me. And we'll talk together for half an hour or so, something like that. And then we'll have an interval during which you can get yourself another drink and keep talking. And then after that, I'm going to be opening up part of John's Gospel to look at Jesus' answer to our question tonight, what if I could live forever? So that's roughly where we're going to go over the course of the evening. So I wonder if everyone's found a seat. Jeremy, would you come and join me, please?
Try not to fall off the platform.
Not yet. That's right. So Jeremy, thank you so much for being with us this evening. I was talking to a friend of Jeremy's about interviewing him here, and he said, you know, he is really quite unwell, be gentle, but it must be in some ways the last thing you want to do, come out on an evening like this and be grilled. But Jeremy has told me to be as pushy as I like. Is that right? Do you want to
please
just authenticate that for
me? Push away.
Good. Jeremy is no stranger here. First started coming to church here about 30 years ago.
I'm afraid so, yeah. I was at kindergarten in those days.
Something like that. Well, I'm going to give that away. So for those who don't know Jeremy, many will. Jeremy Marshall is 53, married to Jeanette, with three children, two of them university age, one just now in the upper sixth. And I guess the first question would be, how have the last few years been for you?
Well, maybe the best way to illustrate it, Charlie, is to tell you a story. Imagine that there's a climber in the Alps who's climbing away and having fun climbing, and suddenly he slips and falls down a very steep slope and is about to fall to his death over a sort of 1,000-foot drop, when at the last minute his rope coils around the bush on the edge of the cliff. So he's left hanging there, the rope around the bush, and his legs are sort of dangling on eternity. And he can't pull himself up. There's nobody around. He's in a desperate place. So in complete despair, he calls out, "Oh God, if you're there, please help me." And there's a pause. And then this voice comes from below, and the voice says, "Let go and I'll catch you." So then there's an even longer pause. And then the man hanging from the bush, and in the meantime, the bush is sort of straining at the roots and about to fall out. The man says, "Is there anyone else there?" So I am that man hanging on the rope. Yeah.
That's been your experience. Just so you would diagnosed with cancer, tell us when and how. Give us some of that.
I don't want to make it kind of gory or morbid details.
Yeah, but the medics here will want to know.
Yeah, exactly.
At least some, you know, they are like.
If
that.
Anybody has a kind of wonder cure, you could let me know. That would be much appreciated. So, 4 years ago, around the time of the Olympics, I just noticed I had this small lump on my ribs. I went to the GP, and the GP said, "Oh, don't worry, it's just your advanced age, 53 or 49 or whatever it was then. It's just a fatty lump. It's fine, but." We'll run some tests anyway, nothing to worry about. So any of you who've been through the medical system, you know what happens is you get referred from specialist to specialist, and each person says, "I don't know what that is actually, we need to run some more tests." And then eventually they say, "Actually, we're going to refer you to the Marsden." And if you know the Marsden, they do one thing only 100%, which is cancer, which is, you know, you have to be kind of rather stupid not to figure out what that means. So anyway, went to the Marsden, and they said, "You've got a really rare type of cancer. It's a type of sarcoma, which, if you're into medical stuff, is a cancer of the sort of muscle layer or muscle tissue." And the oncologist was quite optimistic and said, "Oh, yeah, this, you know, should be treatable. Your odds are reasonably good." He did say, "If it ever comes back, you're toast." But he said, "No, it should be fine, and we'll."
That's
we'll...
his best bedside manner.
Yeah, that's so. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I had various things. Surgery, radiotherapy, and then after a bit, they said, "Oh, you're all clear. Come back every 3 months," which then became 6 months for scans. So everything was fine. So I kind of forget until about 2 days before the scan, you forget about it. Anyway, so nearly 3 years went by. So May last year, 2015, I was round at a friend's house having dinner. It was hot. It was in the summer, and I had like a polo shirt. And I went to adjust the collar on the shirt. And I felt this huge lump on my collarbone. So I thought, you know, I know what that is. In fact, I just had to leave immediately and say, "I'm sorry, I'm feeling ill, I have to go home." So, yeah, I went back to the went back to the Marsden, and I'm not quite sure how they missed it in the screening. I decided not to sue them. But
so far.
Yeah, these things happen. And you think hospitals make errors, you should look at banks. But anyway. So the oncologist said, after they run the test, said, basically, I'm really sorry you've had it. There's tumours all over your body, and there's nothing we can do. We'll try and sort of see if we can control it, but it's incurable. And you've got 18 months to live.
And that was how long ago?
17 months. So,
17 months. Yeah. So you said the date they gave you?
Yeah, it was the 13th of June. So the 13th of December would be 18 months, which I plan to remind my oncologist. But
yeah, ring him up on the day.
The truth is, with cancer, it's nobody really knows. And also, in the meantime, and I'm enjoying kind of baffling the medics, they'd completely changed the diagnosis and said it's not the same type of cancer that I had before. It's a completely different one, also very rare, which is not good, by the way. If you want to have cancer, have a common one, because there's a lot more. Next time you order that at your local hospital, because there's a lot more drugs and stuff. So that was that. So I've been through... I used to have a full head of hair, and I've been through two rounds of chemo. I'm just about to start a third one. And the chemo has worked in the sense of that it's sort of every time when you have chemo, it shrinks them and you feel terrible. Then you stop having chemo and they start growing again. So it's a bit like pushing a boulder up a hill, and then as soon as you let go, it starts rolling back on you. And then just to finish off the kind of whole medical stuff, not so that you all feel sorry for me, my wife and I decided at the end of the first chemo, let's have a holiday of a lifetime. So we thought, let's go to the Galapagos. And en route to the Galapagos, the retina detached. And unfortunately, we were in the middle of the Amazon rainforest when this happened in Ecuador. So by the time we got back to St. Thomas's, it was too late. So this eye is basically blind. But the eye specialist, great chap, said, oh, don't worry, lots of people only have one eye. You're fine. There's nothing wrong with your other eye. And then in May this summer, this eye went as well, unrelated to the cancer. I mean, you couldn't believe, talk about bad luck. I mean, it's ridiculous. So anyway, for several months, I was kind of blind, basically. Couldn't see anything out of either eye. And this eye has recovered somewhat, but then in the last few weeks, it started going wrong again. So, and I've had numerous operations on both eyes. So I've got to have another one. And as I said to someone the other day, it's a pity that hospitals don't give you frequent flyer points, because if they did, I would be sitting with a massive balance.
You were saying earlier you'd never been ill before that?
No. I mean, I guess like a lot of people. The only time I'd ever been in a hospital in my life was, which is a ridiculous reason, was for sports injuries, playing football, like sort of doing a tendon or whatever. Yeah, no, I'd never been in a hospital, never even visited a GP. Within 2 minutes, your whole life is totally transformed and will never be the same again. Yeah.
Thank you. And in a second, I'll ask you more about how that felt, how you thought about that. Let's, again, just keep getting some background. So you, tell me about you and God. So you're a Christian. You became a Christian when you were a teenager. Just say why did you become a Christian?
Yeah. The reason I became a Christian was that I suddenly realized it was true. So my parents made me go to church, which I thought was extremely boring and irrelevant and kind of just a fairy story and, wasting my time. And like a lot of stroppy teenagers, and if you have teenagers, I used to give my parents, especially my father, a very hard time about, what a repressive thing it was to force your children to go to church. But one day, nothing to do with church, really. I would say, this sounds more mystical than it's meant to be, but I would say I had a personal meeting with Jesus Christ. It wasn't like a road to Damascus where the heavens open. I didn't see anything, but suddenly, just in going about sort of normal life, I suddenly realized it's true. It's not just something that your parents force on you. It's actually true. And if you like, the sort of religious facade of church and church buildings and stuff went away, and you realize there's actually a person here, and that person, Jesus Christ, is actually who he says he is, so he's actually God. And more than that, that Jesus actually came and lived in this world and came and died on a cross despite being God, and he could have saved himself any time, but he came to rescue us from the mess we're in, and trust me, I'm in a bit of a mess now, so I appreciate that very much. And more than that, that when he died, he actually also came back from the dead. So within just a few minutes, somehow the reality of Jesus Christ not just being a person in the Bible, but actually being alive and real here and now came to me. How that happened, I don't know. And again, it wasn't like some incredible vision or that, you know, anything particularly dramatic happened, but I just came to the realization that Jesus was who he said he was.
Thank you. Then I'm going to bring you forward, talk a little bit about your time in the city, your career in the city, because in some ways you're as much an expert on life as on death, maybe more so. You had a long, successful career here in the city. How did you get started in the city? How did that happen?
Well, I think it was an accident, first of all, probably like for a lot of us. So I went to the local bog standard comprehensive in a place called Hemel Hempstead, which any of you know Hemel, it's, you know, not the world's most exciting town. No insult to anyone from Hemel Hempstead. But then somehow, I think probably through some sort of accident of administration, I ended up in Cambridge, and then, you know, you go on the kind of graduate milk round. So I worked mainly for Credit Suisse for 20-odd years, mainly in private banking, which is an interesting field. So I used to run the UK private bank for Credit Suisse and also worked for about 10 years in Switzerland. And then about 8-9 years ago, yeah, I was at my desk and got a phone call from a headhunter who said, would you be interested in working for C. Hoare & Co?
So I explained earlier that maybe not everyone will have heard of Hoare & Co. So I used to work for a private bank. I used to work for Coutts, not for very long. And that's where the Queen banks, Coutts. But that, compared to Coutts, your bank was more exclusive, is that right?
Well, we felt very sorry for both the staff and especially Her Majesty. You know, it's obviously Coutts is owned by us, basically. It's owned by the taxpayer. So yeah, then the Hoare's is owned still by the Hoare family. It's maybe an unfortunate name. I've heard every joke you can possibly imagine. That won't be repeated, but no, it's owned by 8 family members who are about 340 years on from the founding of the bank. And they're on the 11th generation of family ownership. The family are great fun. They're such good people. The word private doesn't even begin to start it. You know, they don't advertise. We don't advertise. Just keep a very low profile. The family also have, which is very unusual, unlimited personal liability, which, as they cheerfully say, means down to the shirt on their back. So they're the only bank of that type in the UK. That means if the bank goes under, they are personally liable.
And were you invited to join them in that arrangement?
No, fortunately not. Okay. To my wife's great relief, yeah. So it was really a great place. I mean, I stepped down as CEO when I was ill. I was the first non-family chief executive, but it was great fun. And the fun really came from the family. Any of you, has anyone here been to Stourhead in Wiltshire, which is, I think, the second most visited National Trust property? That's their family seat. One time, Henry, who's the family's patriarch, was going on a tour around, and somebody asked the guide, "So what happened to the Hoare family?" To which the guide said, "They all died out hundreds of years ago." To which Henry said, "Oh no, we didn't." So that's very much their spirit of sort of still living the spirit of the founder.
So I'm not going to ask you how much money you need to get an account, but you know, an orderly queue.
I don't think you would qualify, Charlie.
That's right.
Sorry,
I think unless
curates at St Helens get a lot more than
that's
think.
Right. Well, you know, there's people here who can make that happen. So over your career, you've worked with a lot of people. You've managed clients' money. You've seen successful people making the most of what the world has to offer. I guess, tell us about life. So does that make people happy? Is that what life is?
Yeah. Now, on the business side, before I was doing private banking, I used to run strategic planning for Credit Suisse. So I work with people who probably lots of you have heard of, like Ozzie Grubel, Joe Ackerman, Brady Dugan, Stephen Hester, and others, who are very, very impressive people. The main thing I would say from working with people like that is it's really, really tough at the top, especially in banking. Some of you may think about right too, with all the sort of crimes that bankers get up to. But people make huge, huge sacrifices to become CEO of a big global bank. And when they get there, and often, not always, but often it means, you know, divorce and all kinds of family issues, because it's relentless, the pressure to be CEO of such a big organization. And there's always, you know, in any big global bank, there's always something going wrong somewhere. And when it goes wrong, you know, the friendly regulators tend to take a dim view and kind of come piling in with their size 12 boots. So a lot of people at the top, in my experience, when they get there and they've devoted their whole life to climbing the greasy pole, when they get there, they find it's not nearly as rewarding as they think it would be. And somebody said, which I think is true, that all careers end in failure, which if you think about it, is true. You know, even the most successful person, I mean, we were talking about that earlier, I would say the most, when I joined the city in 84, the firm everybody died to work for was S.G. Warburg. Some of you are old enough to remember that. And that was founded in about 1950 by a guy called Sigismund Warburg, who was a really remarkable man who was a Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany. He founded this firm, and it revolutionized the city, and it was absolutely the place that everybody wanted to work. But within a couple of years of his retirement and then death, the firm had collapsed, and it was taken over by what's now UBS and completely disappeared. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of you have never even heard of it. So this idea that it's either, you know, really rewarding to be at the top or that you leave some kind of legacy is just not, it's just not true. And it's a lie that being successful in a career will make you happy. It will not. Failure is success at things that don't really matter. Failure is success at things that don't really matter. And the city, if you're starting out, puts you up this ladder and says, climb the ladder, you will be happy. But it's not true. You won't be. So maybe some of you think, well, yeah, actually, I don't want a big career, but what I'd really like is lots of money. And obviously, there are things you can do in the city which don't have a particular kind of career profile, but where you can become very wealthy, hedge funds and other things. And that's what I spent most of my career dealing with. And now I'm not saying money is a bad thing or that we should all sort of become monks and live off bread and water, but some of the most miserable people I've ever met have been very, very wealthy people. And money solves some problems, but it brings others. And I would say the most, not always, and you get some people who are very good at dealing with it, but many wealthy people have problems in their families, especially the whores are very good at managing family dynamics, but lots of families are not. And you typically get a situation where you have a patriarch who's made all the money, and then they try and control their children. And the children rebel or get into alcohol or drugs or all sorts of things. And the family just ends in a massive internecine warfare. And it's just full of bitterness and anger. So if you're here this evening and you're thinking, if only I had a promotion, if only I was in XYZ job, or if only I had 10, 20, 30 million in my bank account, I'd be happy. I can tell you from personal experience, it's not true.
And you knew that while you were... You must have had some ambition. You must have
Oh,
had...
yeah, no, I did. Yeah, plenty of... Yeah, I'm afraid so. Confess your... This is a good place to confess your sins, isn't it, really? Yeah. We should have one of those, like, kind of curtains in front.
Is that bad ambition? But you knew it was all House of Cards?
No, I didn't. No. No. No, definitely not, Charlie. No. When I was starting out, even though I was a Christian, I was highly ambitious. Too ambitious. I mean, I really annoyed the hell out of my wife. In my late 20s by just, you know, working crazy hours and coming in at 2 a.m. and some of you will recognize that. And I regret that. I have apologized about 4,000 times since for doing that. But I didn't realize it at the time, because when you're young, you don't really, you think that's just the way it is. And there's tremendous social pressure to get on and get more money and get a career. But I don't think it's necessarily wrong, but if we make that our God, if we make that the center of our life, we will not be happy. God designed us to be happy by knowing him and having a relationship with him. And if we try and put something else, like the mighty dollar bill, in the place of him, it will not make us happy.
Thank you. Let me move on, I guess, to... I suppose we all know that we are mortal, but I think you probably know that more than most. How does a Christian think differently about death, about what happens after death?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm a Christian, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but facing death is really difficult. I mean, I don't want to give some kind of glib answer here that everything's fine and I'm kind of smiling around. I'm not. I want to live. I don't want to die. I'd much rather live. And I'm really happy to be alive, actually. It's good. Every day I wake up and think, thank you, God, I'm alive, and obviously I feel all right, apart from days when I don't feel all right. I think the key thing as a Christian is, do you trust God? So there's a story in the Bible where Jesus is going across the lake of Galilee with his disciples, most of whom were experienced fishermen. And Jesus, who Christians believe was fully God but also fully human, is fast asleep on a pillow in the boat. And this tremendous storm blows up. And these are experienced fishermen, but they're basically just, you know, panic-stricken, and they're facing death right there. We're going to drown. And they shake Jesus and say, "Wake up, don't you care? We're going to drown." And Jesus gets up and rebukes the storm, first of all, and says, "Be still." And immediately the wind and the waves stop. So Jesus rearranged tens of billions of atoms of water, because if you know anything about sailing, if the wind drops, the waves still stay for a certain time. And he also rebukes his followers for a lack of faith. So when you're feeling it, when you are ill, the temptation is that you doubt the goodness of God, and you say, "Well, God, you know, how can this happen to me, and why am I going to die?" And that's not an easy thing to do. And the only way as a Christian to deal with that is to say, "God, I trust you. I trust that this is part of your plan." Because Christians believe that God is in control of everything, like Jesus was in control of the storm. But then sometimes God, you think, "Well, is he asleep? You know, what's going on?" Or you may think, "Well, he's awake and actually doesn't care." So that the acid test for the Christian is, it's easy to trust God if everything's going well, if you're getting promoted, if you're making lots of money. That's easy. The acid test is when the storm is raging, do you trust God then? And yes, I do. And I believe that Jesus is in my boat, so to speak. And although he may appear to be asleep, and if he wants to cure me, he can, and if he doesn't, that's up to him. But what I have to do is to trust him. And like a small child crossing the road with a father holding his hand, just to put my hand in his and say, "Okay, you take me where you want me to go." Now, maybe some of you are thinking, and if I were you, I would think the same thing. "Well, that's all very well, Jeremy. It's kind of comforting to think that. But is it actually true?" And that's actually a great question, because all sorts of things can be comforting and helpful. I just went on a holiday with my wife, because we had to cancel all our holidays because of the different operations. And we went to a place called Sedona, Arizona. Anyone ever been there? No? Okay, it's quite nice, actually. But it's a real, they've got this real kind of, we didn't only go there, but it's got this real thing about vortexes. It's all very new age, that if you go there and you can kind of stand on a certain place, it gives you an energy vortex. It's all rubbish, if you ask me. But anyway, if you're into that kind of thing, Sedona is the place to go. But the question is there actually a reality there that makes a difference? And that's the same question about the Christian faith. Not is it helpful if you're ill, which obviously it is, versus the alternative, which is, you know, just it, you've had it, that's it. But is it true? And I really believe with all my heart that the Christian faith is true, and that there is more to come. And the reason I think that is because, and I was convinced of it before, but I'm even more convinced of it now. And now is a lot tougher question to answer than academically, you know, when you're 80, that when I die, and by the way, sorry friends, we're all going to die at some point, you know, Benjamin Franklin said there's two things you can avoid, death and taxes. Having worked in Switzerland, I can tell you, you can avoid taxes, but you can't avoid death, okay? The death rate in this room is going to be 100%. I'm sorry, if any of you think you're immortal, then you might want to check out afterwards. So the Christian believes that this life is but like kindergarten. It's just a brief period, and if we trust in Jesus and we believe in him, that we will go to be with him when we die.
You were saying earlier when we were talking how different that is to what most of your friends who don't believe in God, what they say when you tell them how ill you are. Say a bit more about that. What's the sort of normal British reaction?
Yeah, embarrassment. Yeah, people. By the way, I feel convicted myself that when I had friends, family in the same situation, you just don't know what to say to people. And it is difficult to know what to say to people. I think that, by the way, if you're not sure, the best thing is just to be friendly and to sort of chat to people. And the worst thing to do is to, which I did in the past, is just to avoid people because you're embarrassed. But yeah, people who are not Christians, they don't know what to say to you. And the main thing they tend to say is be positive. Think positive thoughts, which is, you know, I feel like saying, "Would you like to meet my oncologist? He's just told me I'm going to die." I mean, yeah, I can think as cheerfully as I like, but it's not going to change his diagnosis. So I think we're, as a society, we're embarrassed about death, which is a very British thing. And also, we're afraid of it. I think embarrassment hides death because it is a terrifying, thing to have to face death. Was it Woody Allen said, "I don't mind the thought of my death, I just don't want to be around when it happens." It's also the kind of bluntly messy process that tends to lead up to, especially, you know, it's one thing if you get killed in a car crash, but if you, you know, cancer tends to be not very pleasant way to sort of to snuff it. So the person who's not a Christian has really, sadly, doesn't know what to say.
And as you've thought about what comes after death for you, what are you holding on to? What do you think that's going to be like?
I think, you know, I find I'm sort of driven back to the Bible. And the Bible, we believe, is God speaking to us. God caused it to be written thousands of years ago, but I really believe that God also caused it to be written so that it will speak to any of you who want to listen to what it's got to say. You know, Jesus said, "Those who have ears to hear, let them hear." So the Bible is speaking. The question is, do we want to hear? What does the Bible have to say about death? Well, it's not God's design for the world. Death came into the world because of our sin. And God will and has defeated death. That's why he sent his son into the world to rescue us from death and evil. And for me, the most convincing proof of the Christian faith, and one that is, again, you know, of kind of tremendous relevance to me right now, is that I really believe that the only logical explanation for what the Bible says is that Jesus, as he said he did, actually did rise from the dead. And, you know, if you want to study the original sources, four Gospels, you can do that. I'm sure lots of your friends, if you're here and you're not a Christian, would be happy to do, you know, one-to-one Bible reading with you and just go through, say, John's Gospel and try and understand what happened. But Jesus didn't have to die. He was God. He could have saved himself any time, but he deliberately submitted himself to death and then came back. So death is a terrible enemy because it's like a precipice, like my Alpine story, which everybody eventually falls off. And nobody knows what happens afterwards. But actually, one person did come back. Now, other people in the Bible were raised to life, like Lazarus and others, the widow of Nain's son, but they all died eventually. But Jesus came back from the dead, thereby proving that he was God. So and again, this may sound a bit kind of weird, or I know I'm going to tell you anyway, but whether you think it's weird or not, that's tough. So I feel since I've been ill that again, not in a sort of supernatural way that I'm seeing visions. I can't really see much anyway, visions or anything. I can't even see it. I keep tripping over the pavement, so I can't see well enough. But the reality of Jesus Christ today on the 7th of November 2016 is really powerful, and it can be for you as well. All you have to do is to say, "God, if you're there, speak to me." And often God speaks to us through his word. And when I was having radiotherapy a while ago, radiotherapy is really boring because you have to lie there completely still for about half an hour. And if you move a muscle, then they have to start the whole stupid process all over again. So it's very dull. And so I was lying there and I thought, I'll memorize a psalm, being a bit of a sad character, just to kind of keep me amused. And as I was lying there, I was going through Psalm 34. And in my mind, I came across Psalm 34, verse 5, which says, "Those who look to God, their faces are radiant." So I thought, oh, that's funny. I'm having radiotherapy. I've got a radiant face. So I started laughing. The radiographer said, "No, don't laugh. You're ruining the tracking system." But I felt that was God speaking to me and reassuring me that, you know, I'll never leave you or forsake you, that I'm with you, and that when you die, I'll take you to be with me. So that's what I believe. And that's what I recommend to you because, sorry, each of you is going to be one day sitting here. I hope you all live to 100 and never have any illness, but, you know, that's not the way life is. I thought I'd live till I was 90 or something, and suddenly here I am telling you about all my various interesting illnesses. So each of you, I'm sorry, will be one day here. So please, friends, take the Lord Jesus with you. He offers a way out of death. Being a Christian is not an insurance policy. I can't suddenly pull out, you know, the policy and say, "Oh, I'm a Christian, I'm not going to die." No, it doesn't work like that at all. But what Jesus says is, "I will never leave you or forsake you. I'll be with you. And I have been through death and I've come back."
Jeremy, thank you. I think that's a great place to pause. Jeremy, thank you very much. We'll take a short break now, but I wonder, could we just show our appreciation, Jeremy, for coming and speaking? Thank you. We'll take a 10-minute break. My notes here say, before I die, I want to drink. I think that let's have those in the right order. So please do find yourself another drink. But then you might like, during the break, to talk about things Jeremy has said. That'd be a great thing to do. But also, you might like to say what your answer would be to the question we've been asking everyone. So before I die, I want to, what would it be for you? What would make life worth it, make life full? So 10-minute break, and please do help yourself to another drink, and I'll be back up in about 10 minutes. Thank you. Thank you. And could I ask you, if they're still on your chair, to pick up the copy of John's Gospel that is there on your chairs. John's Gospel is a record of Jesus' life by one of his disciples, the things that Jesus said and did. And Alicia is very kindly going to read for us from page 33. If you turn to page 33, Alicia, come on up. Alicia works in the city here and comes to St. Helens. And is going to read at the bottom of page 33. You'll see where it says, I am the resurrection and the life. So Jesus addressing some of these questions we've begun thinking about this evening. Alicia, thank you.
Can you hear me okay?
Okay, good.
Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Now when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. But Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into this world.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed for reading for us. Please keep that open. I want to look at what Jesus would say to some of these. I want to thank you. Obviously, we thank Jeremy. Thank you as well for being here to think about these big but difficult issues. And thank you to those of you who've taken part in kind of slightly low budget social experiment that we've been running. I don't know if we can have the first picture just up there. So outside, on the way past, as that come up, there it is. We've had a board saying, before I die, I want to, dot, 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 the question you've just talked about. And it's the question that focuses our mind, doesn't it? What is my life all about? And I've got 3 points of reflection on Jesus' encounter with death, with his friend Lazarus' death. And the first one there is, I think, comes off what we've seen on that board, which is, first one, that we all want to live. We all want to live. And we've got some examples of things people have said. So if we could click on, and let's zoom in on a few of them. So that one was slightly unfortunate. We rubbed that one off. If you don't know, Hiscox is the building next door. And I don't know whether Mr. Hiscox saw that as he walked. Maybe it was him. I don't know. Let's have another one. So some of them, that says own a dog.
some of them were, you know, just straightforwardly achievable. You could do that one tomorrow. Others were harder, make my life worthwhile. That gives you a feel of the range. Own a dog, make my life worthwhile. We had some that were not easy at all. Be a good man. How do you do that? We had others that were sort of, I don't know, is this one sad? Is it hopeful? Fall in love again? Is that someone who expects that soon? Or is that someone who's given up hope? We had one that was quite fun. So I don't know whether I would love, if anyone can do handwriting analysis, I'd love to know if that is two people or one person who came back and changed. So we want to define ourselves. Here's one. So we did it. We made someone's life worthwhile. So I don't know what you said around the room. We all want to live. And the flip side of that is that we all, I think, if we're honest, share the same reaction to death. We all feel that suffering and death is terrible, is a waste. We feel it's wrong. We react in the way that Jeremy has helped us understand. That's how we react to our friends. We have a British embarrassment, but underneath this feeling, this is wrong. We are potentially angry with God about it. And if you've got the page open, just have a look at, I think, the question that we often want to ask God. I don't know if you're surprised to see it three times in a Bible passage. So we had it in verse 21 at the top of page 34, where Martha says, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Where were you, God? And it's there again in verse 32. There are two sisters and a brother in this story. The brother has died. The two sisters are weeping. Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And I think verse 37 at the bottom of that page is exactly the question philosophers have been asking of death and of God. Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man, if you're so powerful, God, couldn't you have kept this man from dying? That's the story. Lazarus is Jesus' friend, and he has died. You'd think if you've got a hotline to Jesus, there should be something he could do about death. And we feel death is wrong. And Jesus agrees. That again, I don't know if that's a surprise to people here. If you look at verse number 33, Jesus reacts to Mary's grief and her friends. He was deeply moved in spirit and greatly troubled. Verse 35, Jesus weeps. Verse 38, he's deeply moved again. And that is a classically English translation. Jesus is deeply moved. You can imagine that at C. Hoare & Co. You know, they're deeply moved about the wrong biscuits or something. But Jesus is a Middle Eastern man. And this is the sort of funeral you see on the news after an atrocity. Jesus feels death deeply. Agrees with us. We want to live. And that is why we have this industry on staying young and finding cures and the desire to make life count. Let me show you a headline from Time magazine. 2045, allegedly, is the year when man becomes immortal. And that would be an exciting story any day. But let me show you where I was when I saw that. These are the two books in the room I was in. When I saw that headline, we had the Time magazine, and that is the intensive care unit relatives comments book. I was there because my uncle was dying in the room next door. So you imagine how many people had been through that room. There was nothing else to read in there. Let's read about living forever. While just the other side of a door, people they love and care about were dying. And I think we know that a good life, a full life, doesn't remove the desire to live more. I don't know, you have friends who seem to pack in so much to their life, and you think, well, have I done enough? Is my life going to be worth it? I was at a funeral for a friend, and three friends. We didn't know that he'd committed suicide until we got there and was reading on the back the charity we were raising money for. And the idiot taking the funeral was talking about how wonderful death was. And how positive, really. And we looked at each other and just, that is a lie. Certainly the friend who'd seen him that morning, the morning he'd killed himself, thought, he didn't feel, oh, great. He thought, if only I could have stopped that. If only we could have helped him see something. We all want to live. Second reflection, and Jeremy has said this authoritatively and well. Second reflection, we will all die. We will all die. I think the first of my observations, I think our culture gets well. We are obsessed with living and making the most of everything. But the second one, our culture is very bad at. We will all die. You could say that our culture is systematically hiding from the most important reality, the most important thing about us, and our greatest pain. Someone on the BBC recently pointed out that only three generations ago, by the age of 30, you'd have seen about a dozen deaths. You'd have been involved with them. You'd have known what was happening. You'd have seen it. Whereas now, it is hidden. It is managed. It's behind curtains. It's where professionals, and some of you are the professionals who deal with it, but for most of us, it's hidden away. I listened to a radio interview with a hospital chaplain, and her job was to rush to the bedsides of dying people to pray with them. And she said, nobody will give me a straight answer. She said she'd be rung in the middle of the night by ITU nurses, by people whose job is to deal with people who are dying. And they'd say, you must come. And she'd say, why? Say, well, you know, so-and-so is not well. So if they're not well, I'll come in the morning. No, they're very sick. I think even if you work in ITU, you couldn't say the word dying, even though that is where we all will be. And because we hide from death, I think that means we don't know why we're dying, and we don't plan for it. See, for Jesus, death is not something to hide from. For Jesus, and Jeremy said this, death is an enemy to confront. So we left Jesus with tears rolling down his face, weeping, Middle Eastern man at a funeral. But so far, you might say, he has been, you know, no more use than your auntie at a funeral. You pass the man a tissue, but otherwise he's not been much use. But pick it up after verse 37. As Jesus, deeply moved again, he comes to the tomb. Back in verse 34, his reaction is, take me there. Where have you put him? And that is an unusual reaction to death in the way Jesus means it. We're told earlier in the gospel, Jesus was sent into the world so that people would not perish. Jesus is on a search and destroy mission on death. And our culture hides from the reality of death. But in Jesus' teaching, death is no surprise. And it's no surprise we hide from it either, because not just the horror of it, but Jesus says that death is related to our responsibility. Jeremy said it's because of our sin, that the death I will face one day, that you will face, is my fault. It's not how God intended things, Jeremy said. That it is to do with our rejection of God is in fact the only reaction a holy and perfect God can make to the way that you and I live our lives. I am responsible for my death. It is the right response of a good God to me. And you may well have questions about that. Please come and find me at the end. I'm not planning to run away. I think, would you at least notice that Jesus' worldview is a coherent explanation for three unavoidable truths in our world? There's the one that we all die. There's the one that we all hate that. We feel death is wrong. And there is also just the mess our world is in. The disarray our world is in, and the evil in our world, of the kind that you'd think a good God would be concerned about, would want to do something about. Well, the Bible says that our short life expectancy, our short lifespan, is a message about the condemnation and anger from God that waits for us after death. That is the real death, not non-existence in Jesus' teaching, but a conscious experience of the anger of God. And because we hide from death, we never get the chance to think about why. Why am I dying? And also, we never get the chance to plan for it, which is crazy, isn't it? And I don't mean the sort of classic FM, is your funeral plan in place adverts. I mean planning properly for what it means, giving serious time to it. We plan for all sorts of things, don't we? Pensions, I guess, around here. There's people in that industry, life changes. My mum has a 20-year death plan.
My mum is 84 this year. She has a 20-year death plan. She's kind of halfway through, which involves gradually moving to a smaller house and moving out of the village and into the town. And she's the eyesight is gone, basically, but she's still driving. So that is slightly alarming. You know, kind of, do you want me to drive you to the shops? No, I'll walk. Thank you, mum. But her plan... And she's visiting the kind of the nursing homes, and you know, people think she's there to be kind to the people in them. She's not. She's shopping. She wants to know where she's going to be, and that is, I think, enormously wise and enormously kind. She was fed up with her mother, who you know made crazy choices about where she wanted to live, and you're going to have to drag me out of here. My mum is ready for the next 10, 20 years, but. We don't plan so well for what comes after we die. We don't give it the same kind of serious thought we would give even choosing a new car. The daughter of my uncle, my cousin, when we were talking in the ITU residence, whatever it is, relatives waiting room with the magazine, she said, I just think what happens after death is just such a wonderful adventure, isn't it? There's that positivity again. And I didn't say, because I don't think you say this to a daughter while her father is dying, but for us, how do you know? What makes you think that? What makes you think it is a wonderful adventure after you die? Have you given it? And the person who told you that, what kind of credentials do they have? What kind of expertise do they have to tell you what will happen when you die? And that's where I want to go with our third reflection. So we all want to live, we will all die, but third reflection, with this passage open, you can live forever. You can live forever. That Time magazine isn't just a kind of science fiction dream and a goal. It's not just a slightly unhappy coincidence in a waiting room. It is what Jesus offers. It's shot through this story. I hope, please, you'll keep these. Please take these away. Read them again, as Jeremy encouraged you to. Ask God to speak to you. And the Christian claim is that he does in this book. But read this story in John 11, and you'll see shot through it that Jesus relates to death differently to other people. So back before we read verse 11, verse 12, he talks about death as if it was a sleep, that he could go to Lazarus and wake him up from it. And again, depends slightly how teenage your children are, whether you kind of think that waking someone from sleep is an easy thing or a hard thing. But Jesus, for him, that is how he sees your death. Like a kind of comfy lie-in, early night in a comfy lie-in, and then he'll wake you up. Or verse 17, as he goes there, he is 4 days late, but he still goes. And he marches, he meets Martha, he meets Mary, he says, take me to the tomb. And he goes there, verse 38, he says, 39, take away the stone. And Martha, she is the practical one in this family, always through the Gospels. And she says, don't take away the stone because of the smell. Again, it's maybe slightly more biological than you were hoping for this evening, but it's a hot country. Lazarus has been dead 4 days. That's why you rush a funeral in a hot country. And Jesus has total confidence in the face of a rotting corpse, which is what you and I will be one day. And they've said to him, if you were here, Lazarus would not have died. And Jesus' point is, I'm here now. And the opportunity is not missed. I want to draw your attention to verse 25 and 26 particularly. I think it's at the heart of what Jesus is teaching here. Jesus said to Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Do you see how personal it is both ways? How personal it is about Jesus. I am the resurrection and the life. Again, if your surgeon walked into the ward saying that, you'd think, you know, he was a little bit too big for his boots. I am life. Jesus, that is just a factual CV job description for him. I am the resurrection and the life. It's personal for him. And he offers it personally to, well, to Lazarus, to Martha. But it says, whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. Do you believe me? Do you believe this? Jeremy said it comes down to whether you trust God, whether you trust Jesus. And life in John's gospel, in Jesus' teaching, is not sitting on the clouds and being bored. It's not like being locked in church forever or whatever you think it might be. It is about fullness of life. It's about all the things people have been writing on our boards. It's about all the things you want to do before you die, but done better and done properly. I'm told that we are, if you're born this year, you'll live to 80 if you're male and 83 if you're female. But the key number they're now talking about is the healthy life expectancy. And those numbers are 63, 64. But in John's gospel, when Jesus talks about life, he doesn't mean eking it out in a nursing home. He means feasting and weddings. And you've been paralyzed for 38 years and now you walk. And he means cold water to drink endlessly in a desert when you're thirsty. He means food that satisfies you. He means come and join my family. Have God be your father. Come and move into my house. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? The issue is personal trust. Is Jesus the kind of person you trust to throw a wedding? You trust to bring the water in the desert? Would you trust him to book enough rooms when you go away on the work due? Do you trust him with your death? Just turn on with you to John 14. Just a few pages further on, it's page 43. Where Jesus is the night before his own death. And he says this to his disciples who are worried. It's good, it's that way around. Jesus is dying, they're worried. Jesus is reassuring them. He says, let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, trust God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself. What Jeremy says, death is going to be with Jesus. So the issue is, do you trust Jesus? And a life beyond death, a defeat of death, is possible because Jesus dies our death for us. I am going to prepare a place for you. It's not he needs to change the bed sheets and, you know, make sure the curtains match your favorite color. He is kicking open the door, making the way to get there as he dies in our place. To carry away God's anger with me, the things that I've done that mean that death is the right thing to give someone like me. Jesus is going to take that away as he dies. Says, so now do you trust me? When I say there'll be a room for you, there'll be a place. There is an invitation that is quite a moment, isn't it? On Jesus' behalf. You've been told you're going to die. On Jesus' behalf, I issue you that invitation. Would you like to live forever? That kind of life. And it boils down to, do you trust this man? Is this the kind of man you would trust to book you a room? Jesus has real expertise on death. Comes into this world to die. They kill him, and he is raised, indestructible. Not like Lazarus. Poor old Lazarus is dead again. Jesus is indestructible. He has the specialism. One of my other uncles, I'm at the age where my uncles are dying. I took my uncle's funeral. And he was a paratrooper in World War II. He dropped at Arnhem. He was in one of the Pathfinder squadrons. So I'm in the room taking the funeral. There's all these 85-year-old men who clearly could still take me. You know, you kind of think these are the guys you wouldn't want to get locked in a dark alley with. So their job, if you don't know, their job was to drop a day or so before everybody else behind enemy lines. And they would hold the ground that everyone else would drop on the next day. These are the hard men. They drop into danger. They hold it there for you. I was able to say at his funeral, that is basically Jesus' job. Jesus drops into the mouth of death, and he holds the drop zone. He fights with death, defeats death for you, so that you can pass through it in safety. And so do you trust him? John would say, you must, you should. John would say, I was there that day. There was a rotten corpse. You know, take his sister's word for it. Don't open that tomb. And the rotting corpse, just turn back to chapter 11, because this is quite fun. Page 35. Jesus gives, verse 43, Jesus gives the rotting corpse a command. Jeremy told us that Jesus can tell waves to be quiet, where he says, Lazarus, come out. And I don't know if you, I think it's just a good thing he put the name on. That he's standing in a graveyard. The creator of the world is standing in the graveyard saying, come out. And thank goodness, imagine the lawyers trying to sort that one out if everybody had come out. Jesus says, Lazarus, come out. And the man who had died came out. And his biggest problem is that his big entry back into life, some idiots wrapped him in grave clothes and he's got to kind of shuffle out. John would say, with evidence like that, every day I spent with Jesus over years, what do you want me to believe about him? This is not a normal man. This is a man you should, you must, you can trust with your life. And that kind of decision you are very good at. You make those kind of can I trust this person decision all the time. You hire people, you fire people, you choose whether you want to go and work somewhere, you choose your flatmates, give them keys to your house, you choose someone to marry, you know, you go to sleep and they're in your house, you don't know if they're an axe murderer or what. Yeah, that, you know, you make these kind of big decisions. It's the same one. Do you trust this man? You could read John's gospel, get to know him. What would you have done if you'd been John? Would you have ended up trusting him? And I just want to finish by asking if you would give it good time, this decision. Would you take it seriously? Good time to think it through. I want to tell you one other story about a funeral. In my job, one of the worries is what your first funeral? What's going to be your first funeral? How's it going to go? And my first funeral was a funeral of a man who used to sit just over there on that table there. And he was one of the 7/7 bomb victims, July the 7th bomb victims. Young guy, worked in the city here. He worked in pensions and didn't have a pension. That was one of our jokes. He was kind of mid-30s guy selling everyone else a pension, completely unprepared for retirement. Turns out that was an all right decision in his case. But at his funeral, I was able to say Jamie spent the 6 months before his death investigating Jesus Christ thoroughly. He'd come here every night for a thing called Christianity Explored. We run here. He would ask big questions. Never going to be a pushover. John, come on, or Mark, show me. Show me why I should believe in Jesus. He looked into it, and before he died, he told the guy he was chatting about it with that he trusted Jesus. So at his funeral, I was able to say, he has Jesus' promise. I am the resurrection, the life. Whoever believes in me, even though he dies, will live forever. And I want to suggest it's worth your time to do some of the things Jeremy recommended. Take this away and read it. Or we've also got, you'll find out by the door, Jeremy suggested reading it with someone else. There's something here that would help you do that. We would love you to work out, to plan for, to think about your death before it happens, so that you would be with Jesus when that happens. Thank you very much for being here this evening. Thank you. I hope you'll stay for a long time. I hope you'll be able to stay and chat. Please do come and chat to me if you'd like to, or people on the way out there. You'll see cards on the table that invite you back anytime you'd like. We meet Tuesdays and Thursday lunchtimes during the week, again, thinking about these kind of issues, and then Sundays at 10:30 and 2:30 in Mandarin, 4 and 6. We'd love to help you keep thinking through these huge issues. But thank you very much for being here this evening. I'd like to, again, thank Jeremy very much for giving his time this evening. And please do stay and keep talking. Thank you.